Responsibility is a word that comes up a lot in art, but its meaning is as multifaceted as the artists who use it. It can mean duty of care to your fellow practitioners, responsibility to deliver the product that the subscribers are paying for, or not to traumatise the audience who did not consent to be traumatised, but it can also mean responsibility to be brave. Brave enough to tell the hard stories, to press on wounds that need pressing. Sometimes the old adage that art holds a mirror up to society is far too passive. Sometimes that mirror needs smashing.
In this, the second season of Audio Stage, we're talking responsibility in art. We'll be in dialogue with various practitioners, programmers and thinkers about what responsibility means to them and how we remain ethical in art.
I'm Fleur Kilpatrick.
I'm Jana Perkovic. And today we're joined by two amazing ladies, Esther Anatolitis and Einhard Wynn-Jones, to talk responsibility. In this episode, we're talking about programming, producing, and how organizations can support and foster a diverse and healthy artistic ecosystem.
Einhard is currently the artistic director of Arts House, where as lead producer, she's developed Dance Massive into an internationally respected dance festival. She's initiated FOLA, Australia's leading international biannual festival of live art, and Going Nowhere. She is the founding director and CEO of Tipping Point Australia, developing international and local projects with artists, scientists and communities, energising the cultural response to climate change.
The writer and curator Esther Anatolitis is Director of Regional Arts Victoria, curatorial associate for Édition Vercorin and an advocate for the arts. Esther's past roles span craft and design festivals, literary arts, multicultural arts, publishing and broadcasting, and she specialises in creating new artistic frameworks for established arts companies that generate new thinking and new work. I'm actually not sure what that means, but that's why we're here.
Absolutely. So I guess a good place to start might be, like, there's something that's come up from both of your bios, I think, and from all of the research leading up to this, that I've just seen this word cultural leadership a lot around the both of you. And I guess maybe a good place might be to start with asking you what cultural leadership means to you both.
Wow, that is a really corker of a question. I suppose I feel actually that leadership is about being confused and clearly making a space for that confusion. I think we've seen enough in the kind of political sphere to know that current modes of leadership are not convincing and not potent. And for me, I think the sense of actually being able to embrace risk and failure and the contradictions of our lives and make a space for that, that feels to me what cultural leadership could be.
That's beautiful. It's beautiful that your first word that you go to is confusion. I love that because that feels like we're all sort of bumbling around in that state of confusion at the moment. But yeah, Esther.
I love that. Confusion is in and of itself, when you're left to your own devices, confusion can be such disarray. But if you put it in that framework of leadership and thinking about collaborations and a creation of work and organisations, then leadership becomes the set of platforms that you create or curate so that confusion can be generative, you know, can become something else. I think cultural leadership, is a term I've heard a lot lately, and generally, at least for me, I attribute it to new models of leadership in cultural diversity and the introduction of, I guess, different models of facilitation that are beyond the ones that we would take to be the standard or the norm, which is something I've always admired in the way that Einhard works. So, I don't know. Every time I hear the word leadership, it's something, you know, attached to it, like cultural leadership, you know. But for me, it's a provocation, you know. It's a standard to rise to. It's something which is not definable or complete in and of itself. It's always a collaboration. There's always something at stake to which leadership, you know, approaches or is applied. And so I guess it's just a standard for our practice to live up to.
And I suppose it, you know, still the way that organisations are organised is in a hierarchy, and so that requires, you know, a leader at the top of that pyramid. And I think that feels pretty redundant as a way that we experience the world and the way that we need to, as you say, collaborate. And so I think there's a particular kind of transitional leadership that is required at this point, as we shift generations, as we shift into really clear demands coming from the environment, from the social justice issues that we face globally, that, really necessitate a different way of thinking about leadership. But at the same time, I suppose, you know, there is, I think in my own workplace, there's a point where you just want someone to make a decision so that you can be active. So yeah. There's, I think, that constant balancing of the responsibilities of being a person that has, yeah, some decision-making potential and the capacity, I suppose, to be confused and to allow confusion yeah. into that space.
Well, you were talking just before we started. I asked you, what have you been thinking about this week? And you said we've been, like, the arts in general has felt like it's in a state of free fall in this week, I guess, as we wait to see what this new changing government is going to do and stuff. I guess it's part of that is taking on that responsibility of the confusion for the other artists in a way as leaders, that you're sort of the ones that are keeping a tab on that and sort of guiding a response to the world around us in those moments of chaos.
I think this is one of those fraught times where the challenge for leaders of any kind, including prime ministers, but particularly in the arts, given the free fall, is to reflect back that confusion in a way that does share the empathy and the frustration and the concern that we all have, while absolutely communicating a confidence that the independent arts is a hell of a lot stronger than any arts minister, any doomed to fail attempt to politicise the way that art gets made. So this is a rough patch, and any time we have this kind of confusion and discombobulation, it is a huge opportunity to draw on all the strengths that we have and show the world what we've got.
Yeah, and I think that actually I've had some of the most interesting, provocative conversations in the last 6 months, you know, courtesy of Brandis. Yeah. But I think it, you know, that disturbance and disruption has some energising capacity. And maybe that's also part of the balance of leadership, is to protest and to make clear what the impacts are in that circumstance, but also to really seize on and make visible and support and amplify those things that are emerging, I think, before our eyes around different ways of dealing with this situation that are really empowering and potentially, you know, maybe more sustaining.
What do you think responsibility means to you within your practice as artists?
Responsibility. I don't know. I think it's something that I think of in a number of different contexts. So in terms of my own creative practice as a writer, particularly in the more experimental side of things, then I'm entirely focused and immersed in the joy of play and playing with form and the rigour of research and investigation and the things that I enjoy the most. But when I think about my role in organisations, then for me, responsibility is hugely temporal. And I think a great deal about the future and what it is that I'm creating now that brings something into being that I won't necessarily get to experience the joy and the rigour and the immersion of firsthand. And so I think about the ethics of the way that we do things, what we do, keeping that conversation open about who we're responsible to, including ourselves and each other, and particularly in regional arts, given that we work in a space where, you know, it's a big state. I often talk about Victoria as being compact and arts rich, but it is still a large place of many, many, many places. And so as with any arts organisation, but perhaps in a more pronounced way, there's a sense of being responsible to a whole bunch of artists and members of communities who we don't get to see, but for whom we're imagining something and creating a set of possibilities.
Yeah, I think my sense of responsibility changes on a kind of moment by moment basis, but also I feel like, yeah, that over my life career, that my sense of responsibility and awareness of the kind of benefits of that, I think, has really shifted. So when I was working in London as the artistic director of London International Festival of Theatre, I felt like what I had proposed as a vision was about really kind of shifting the ground of what Lift was about, and my responsibility was to my own vision of turning the kind of colonial view of Australia on its head and bringing back to London the vision of London from, you know, from outside. Mm. And that was kind of sustaining up to a point. But I think for me in that situation, you know, what became really evident was the responsibility to the people on the ground, the people that we were interacting with, that the artists were bringing the work towards. And I suppose I think when I came back to work in Melbourne, that was one of the reasons that I was really fascinated to work within the arts house and the local council context was, you know, there you go, you pay your rates, you know, that's where the money comes from. You're living in the city, making work for those residents, with those residents. It's a very direct relationship. And I really like that sense of accountability as an idea. I didn't know what it meant. And I still, you know, I think there are parts of that which are really delightful, but also sometimes frustrating, because artists like to step into uncharted territory, as they should, and sometimes that means abandoning your responsibilities. And I feel strongly that that's a space that, you know, we still need as a culture, we will always need. So yeah, that's, you know, back to the confusion or the balancing or the, you know, the interesting dichotomy, I suppose, between that sense of risk and responsibility.
So Esther and Harold, what we thought was very interesting was that both of you are very involved in creating dialogue, as in a verbal dialogue with words, around artistic practice and also around the position of art in society, in the Australian society. So the Arts House, now since Anne Harrod has joined, has made a very sustained effort to include discursive events in its program, officially and unofficially. So there was, for example, the Independent Convergence earlier this year that Esther went to and wrote about. And Esther, you have a writing practice that complements your more kind of hands-on arts management, shall we say, leadership practice. And you're very involved, for example, right now in the Senate hearings about arts funding. Is that a fair thing to say?
Oh, somewhat. I mean, with Independent Convergence, I also presented a workshop and I'm quite involved with the development of the next one. Mm. The Senate inquiry, I was certainly invited to present, and I've been trying really hard to just keep track and listen to the others and just share what's come from those, simply because when we talk about cultural leadership, I mean, I said the day after the Melbourne one to a Herald Sun journalist that that was like one of the greatest arts festivals that no one has ever curated, because the opportunity to see this group of people championing what the value of art is, and then have that repeatedly, you know, in Tasmania, in Adelaide, in Brisbane for 2 days coming up. This is just an unprecedented experience in our lifetimes. Exactly as Anne Harrod was saying, it sort of emboldens us now, and we have to be able to, you know, leap on this and keep that momentum going, I think.
So the question sort of coming out of this is, creating a dialogue around art has historically always been quite difficult in Australia. It's not something that people have wanted to do. It's not something that artists or presenters have really wanted to really get involved with. And you are quite different in that. Do you see that as also being a part of cultural leadership or a responsibility that you have?
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, I do think about this a fair bit. And
I know.
No, I mean, well, the practice of it, but also the why colleagues are reluctant. And I think there's a number of different aspects. First of all, there's a sense that opening up a discussion about the value of art or the value of artistic practice tends to be seen by some as being not a rigorous conversation, being a conversation that is populist, is self-justifying, is other than the practice of engaging with the work. There's also, on the other hand, a reluctance to engage with what is seen as a politicised conversation. And so I often talk about the distinction between advocacy and lobbying. Mm. That lobbying, for example, is when you're publicly or privately in conversations with politicians, you're asking for something specific, you're asking for a specific amount of money, you're asking for a specific change in policy, and you're doing that very strategically, hopefully, but you've got this sort of end in mind. Whereas advocacy is just the public positive statement about, or number of statements about what's valuable and exciting and seductive and delicious about art. And that's something that anyone and everyone can be doing because it's as expansive as critique. Critique is a rigorous practice that orients the work to the present and hopefully to the past and the future as well. But advocacy broadens the potential experience and understanding of art. But I think a lot of us are more comfortable speaking in very detailed and focused ways about our particular discipline as opposed to the arts more broadly.
Yeah, I think I've found that as a public servant with the City of Melbourne, we have quite clear guidelines as to what we speak about. Or maybe we don't have guidelines as in written guidelines, but there's you know, I'm not allowed to speak about matters that haven't been discussed and a position taken by the councillors. And part of me feels, you know, frustrated by that. But then actually, I also think that's exactly what a democracy should be. You know, that actually as a public servant, I should be accountable and respectful of the processes of transparency and non-partisan approaches, and that's exactly what I want our government, the behaviour that I want them to have, and which, you know, I feel like we've seen being abandoned in different instances. And I suppose to me it's an interesting rub because I think local councils are now playing such an incredibly critical role in the delivery and the energising of that cultural space. Mm. But at the same time, there's not necessarily a mechanism by which the officers that are really, you know, delivering a lot of those programs can advocate in the way that I think you're talking about. I think there's the potential for that, but I feel like there's some catch-up in terms of how we can make that happen and some of those opportunities, as you talk about, as opposed to necessarily attacking the legislation specifically.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's so much you can say constructively and positing a view, a vision of what the arts is without attacking. But, Angharad, at the same time, you open up these spaces for dialogue with the supper club, with other things that open up those really, you know, great, lovely, big, comfortable spaces in the North Melbourne Town Hall and other places, mm-hmm. which is, you know, a town hall is a gift to its community. It's there to bring people in and make them comfortable and make them feel the dignity of the surrounds and know that that is there to dignify their thoughts and their contribution.
Well, this brings up a really interesting thing that I sort of wanted to talk about already, which was about place and about activation of place, because I've spent some time this morning, as people do, reading the artistic statements of both Regional Arts Victoria and Arts House, and Regional Arts Victoria in particular has a very strong emphasis on place and the creation of place. So what role do you think arts serve in the creation of a sense of place within a community, Esther?
Oh, it's terribly, terribly important. I mean, you know, the work of art asks questions and demands that we do the same. And in a regional context, you know, we often, if we're immersed in a small town, if we're seeking to understand where an artist has come from, then we're keen to know what it is about where and how they live that has informed the work. And sometimes it is about the specifics of place, and sometimes it's about, you know, the culture and the history and the politics. But for the vision of our organisation a few years ago, when I inherited the organisation, as I do, you know, I step in and I inherit a history and, you know, a great set of expectations and extraordinary work. And I was really keen to understand what an artistic framework for a regional arts organisation should be. Mm. You know, what did that mean? And we're an arts organisation that's defined not by, you know, venue like an arts house in terms of, you know, setting those parameters. It's not defined by art form like a dance company or by, you know, program kind of structure like a festival. It's defined geographically by the, you know, the sort of boundaries, the borders of the state of Victoria. And that's a, you know, a kind of a formal definition. But artistically, what characterizes the focus of our scope is the unique places where art is made and shared and talked about and worried about and confused about across Victoria. So we often talk about, you know, touring, for example. Touring of performance can be transformative. You know, where do you go before and after a show here in Melbourne, you know, in a big city? Well, in a small town, that the fact of a show arriving can absolutely change the way that your understanding of the town hall or a place that was not previously a place for performance or discussion or critique of art is now this for this evening, and tomorrow it might not be. So what else is now possible? What has that shifted in the imaginings of the town?
You do have within that vision statement a sort of a focus on creating place for discussion of arts as well as participation in and experiencing of art. How do you go about facilitating discussion in such a diverse community? Like when you say that Regional Arts Victoria is defined by geography, we're talking a very large space, you've got a very dispersed audience that you're playing to, often in very small numbers, but across a very broad spectrum of space. How do you go about creating a conversation when your audience is that dispersed?
Well, in lots and lots and lots of contained ways, and then in some hopefully big and inspiring and well-distributed ways. So the lots of little ways are we have a team of regional staff who work as creative arts facilitators who directly work with artists and organisations to help to develop work and be facilitators and sounding boards and so on. We have things like Home to the Hall is in November, where we celebrate everything that is happening in small halls all across the state. On the complete other end of the spectrum there, there's projects like Small Town Transformation, which is about to happen again, where small towns get to envision how an artistic project could transform their entire town and then apply for and through a competitive process, hopefully secure $350,000 over a good few years to make that happen. And that, of course, then becomes something that, through the collaborations that make that possible, that emanates out more broadly. We do stuff in schools, making sure that kids have got art as part of their education, so that that's very much a part of how they come to formulate ideas of not just what art is, but how discussion happens and how collaboration happens. So lots and lots of different ways, and then I guess the broader advocacy that we do.
At a certain point, Esther, you have said that you were talking about community, using the arts to build community in regional areas can be a matter of life and death. And you said, you know, if there is a bushfire, it is much easier for a community to work together if they had already been getting together to make something else.
Yeah, I've been thinking about that a fair bit. We have, for a number of years, through big projects like Illuminated by Fire, but also through our current creative recovery project, we have three colleagues across the state who are working in bushfire-affected areas, making sure that there's opportunities for people to come together. The context in which I talked about it being a matter of life and death was actually quite important, but also unexpectedly distressing for me. This was the Senate inquiry, and the day before I had hosted a public memorial for an artist who I really admired. And after I said that, I remember stepping out into the corridor afterwards just thinking, what the hell did I just do? What did I say? That was just, I can't believe I said that. And so many friends of ours in the room. And then I thought, my God, well, it is a matter of life and death. Artists in their communities, in small communities, are the ones who make it okay to come together and express things in difficult times. And when you've been able to do that, when there is a place, a space, an okay way to find different ways to express yourself, then when something horrible happens, which unfortunately, given the climate, is only going to happen more and more often, then communities don't have to build that sense of it being okay to be vulnerable together. They don't need to build that from scratch. There has already been experimental, compositional, risk-taking ways to be together in a place and express what is most difficult. And I think that element of resilience is something that is very easy to be taken for granted in a more of an intense urban situation where we come across different perspectives on disasters, large and small, all the time. Whereas in a regional or a remote context, the community is smaller. But when something disastrous happens, it can be a lot more discombobulating than the little dramas that we have in the big city.
Absolutely. I remember my aunt was out in Wandong, which was seriously affected by the bushfires back in 2009, and for years after, when I went up to visit, neighbours just started like debriefing with you, like you'd just talk to anyone and they'd for years, and they'd start telling you about their experience. So one of the neighbours saying, like, you know, I thought I'd saved the house, and then I came out and looked down, the fire was down by the dam, and it turned and it looked at me and it snarled and it came right for me. And like, that was years after. Just every interaction felt like that because it just like unleashed something unstoppable in that community. Angharad, Arts House has always had this incredibly strong focus on risk, and it's not only a space that encourages risk but demands it of artists. That a key part of your criteria for selecting work to develop or program is asking what are the risks that the artist is taking. This is wonderful, but I was also noticing when I was looking at the organisation's website this sentence which said, as a City of Melbourne program, Arts House enjoys stability that allows long-term artistic vision and ongoing investment in new ideas and art forms. And something just clicked for me when I read that. I just went, oh, of course, Arts House gets to create this risky work and gets to champion risk because in large part of its stability. So I guess there's two questions within that. And one is, what role do you think stability has on artistic programming for organisations and artists around Australia?
Yeah, I think it's huge. You know, it's the base level from which any experimentation can happen. And I think it's really evident in other sectors, you know, who would regularly put 10% of whatever expenditure within a sector into research. And I suppose that's what I see, you know, the role of Arts House. It has that capacity from that very stable base and born, I think, out of decades, if not centuries, if not millennia, of extraordinary cultural activity across Victoria and in Melbourne that has meant that we're in this very privileged position of having a city and a state that actually really supports artistic work. And I think that the risk part of it is, I mean, it's not so risky. It's a necessity. You know, it's how forms develop, how new audiences, new artists, how the kind of cultural conversations happen by requiring, I think, a space of unknowing. And, yeah, I constantly am grateful that we have this capacity within the City of Melbourne to be able to do that, and to do that without pretending that it isn't about that, that it's delivering some other kind of agenda. And there are plenty of agendas that should be delivered on. But I think it's a very valuable space to say, you know, as artists, we need to take risks and we need to not know what we're doing and we need to challenge the forms and celebrate that, and to do that with audiences that are up for that risk as well and up for that engagement. And time again, I feel like that's endorsed and supported by those audiences as well, which is fantastic.
I think that question is exactly at the heart of the question of responsibility. You know, the stability of the organisation is the most important, you know, or the foundational responsibility that we have to the artists and to artistic practice. And it's important to recognise that that has come from artists. You know, yes, Arts House is within a government context, but it wasn't other non-artist public servants who came up with that model. And my organisation is an arts organisation that's been around for nearly 50 years, and it came from artists coming together to form a stronger, stable kind of formation that would make more things possible. And so it's the inheritance of that and all the structures around that that really define our responsibility to the arts and to artists in particular.
Well, stability really does echo down to the individual artist. Like, I know as an artist that when I'm unemployed, you'd think, oh, great, that person now has 7 days a week to create their craft. And instead, you know, you've just got 7 days a week to be petrified. Whereas when, you know, when I'm working for Monash, as I am at the moment, I'm like, great, now I've got 5 out of 7 days to create my art and feel confident knowing that the other 2 days have structure and income. And I can make much braver work knowing that I have that, and knowing that I have that backing, that I don't have to be making work that will just be financially gratifying in that moment. It's an incredible thing. And then, of course, that echoes up to a broader spectrum as well. You know, if you feel like that as an individual person, then you feel like that even more so as an organisation when you know that you have, say, 8 employees that are all relying on making sure that this particular show brings in this much income, and when ticket sales are part of your budgets, it's a really big and frightening thing.
And then, you know, sort of one step back from that, you know, what is the lightest structure what is the smallest footprint that the organisation can have so that the resources emanate out into the arts. So this is the responsibility to not be a self-sustaining business for the sake of perpetuating that organisation. And this is where, you know, that kind of every few years refresh of looking at a strategic vision, you know, a plan, a business plan, all those formalities are actually about stepping back and thinking, okay, so who are we responsible to? And are we doing okay?
Oh, Esther, is this what you meant with creating new artistic frameworks? Has my question been answered?
I think your question has been answered. So I I inherit organisations that have been around for a long time, and I always ask the question, why is this organisation still here? What makes it relevant? And what can I, because I have sometimes inherited organisations that have been, you know, comfortable in a certain place, and there has been, you know, a kind of a clear desire from my new colleagues that there is an approach needed that is going to open up new ways of thinking so that we're remaining responsive, so that we're, you know, being an arts organisation that is, you know, agile and relevant and all those kinds of things. And so it's trying to recreate something that draws on a culture and a history, but that very much opens up the potential to create something new, but also that allows, you know, some useful, healthy disruption to keep happening.
So I think we've sort of touched on already about Arts House's application process, but I do think it's very interesting. I remember looking at your expression of interest thing a couple of years ago, and for one thing, it's fast. It's not sort of the whole, like, now hand in 10 pages of application. It's quite like, what is your idea? What are the risks you are taking? And I think that a question that was part of it certainly a couple of years ago was, what will the experience be for the audience? And I think the Arts House has always had this very, certainly in the last few years that I've been going to it, there's always been a sense that the audience completes the performative experience, which is a wonderful thing that I really think comes from how your application process works. And then I think is also sort of funneled out to the broader arts community in Melbourne, that I do feel like audiences are sort of playing more a larger role in the creation of a work these days in Melbourne. But I guess the question from that is, are there things out there that companies can do to elicit a more creative response in their call-outs to artists? What questions create the most exciting work from a company?
Oh, I think I have huge faith in artists and the questions that they ask themselves, actually. So, for instance, with Going Nowhere, which was quite a specific brief in a sense of saying, you know, we know the way that we're conducting ourselves internationally is completely, or in any way, but certainly in terms of international exchange, is unsustainable. And anyone that does any kind of carbon footprinting for themselves knows that as soon as they hop on a plane, and it doesn't even have to be overseas, it just blows their hard-earned recycling points out the window. So I suppose for me, that the Going Nowhere example was like, this is a problem. I can't think of anyone better, any people better to work on that and come up with some phenomenal possibilities and solutions and ideas than artists. So in that sense, I feel like, yep, you can set the toughest brief, and that people will contribute phenomenal kind of imaginative energy into that and come up with beautiful and surprising solutions. But I also feel a responsibility and a desire to hear what those artists themselves are identifying as the questions that they're asking themselves. You know, I think an artist's life is all about that. So I think for myself as a curator, programmer, whatever term you want to call it, it feels to me like to make the space for that and to, yes, to ask the question, to say, if you are unknowing, if you are prepared to put something on the line, whether that's formally or with a, you know, a content question, then, you know, Arts House and plenty of other places across Melbourne and across Australia, but, you know, we're a place that can actually support that, and we're not afraid of that. We don't want it packaged up. You know, we want to problematise it because it's a problematic world that we live in. And I think the audiences that come to Arts House come with that sort of hunger for, you know, for a pretty meaty conversation, to be discombobulated, to be, you know, yes, sometimes entertained and thrilled, as I'm sure we will be tonight with the Melbourne Fringe Club night, but also, yeah, a little bit shaken, a little bit stirred.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to say one thing that has been very interesting about your presence in Melbourne since coming back from the UK has been that you have really alerted us to our ethical responsibilities in art that go beyond just the outcome of making art. You have really change that conversation, I think, also through something like Going Nowhere, Green Ticks, the program where you can get free tickets if you walk to the show instead of driving a car. The entire kind of environmental aspect of making performing arts, I don't think we have discussed it the way that we discuss it now before you came.
Oh, well, I mean, Green Ticks was set up by Stephen Richardson prior to me. So I think that, you know, whilst I would love to take all the accolades, you know, I think, of course, it's been something that we have all been worrying away at and thinking about. But I do feel like I had some extraordinary experiences in London with Tipping Point, which is a UK-based organisation that facilitates civic conversations around climate change and has been doing so for many years. And I was lucky enough to be part of that, to go to, you know, some of those events. And for me, it was like this huge relief, unbelievable relief, to bring in all of the things that we as citizens are concerned about into my professional space as a curator, programmer. And I just felt like, you know, I just want to do more of this, and I'm sure other people, you know, will want the same. And it felt like, you know, doing the Tipping Point events and using open space, which I'm such a massive fan of, I feel like it just, for me, broke through again this kind of false category of the expert and the person listening into a space where we were all enabled to have whatever expertise, whatever knowledge we could and wanted to share. So, you know, in open space terminology, I was a bee in that circumstance. I'd had this fantastic kind of pollination through the experience of being in the UK and seeing the Tipping Point work. And, you know, the time was absolutely ripe when I came back. And, you know, I think that everyone was hungry for those discussions, and those discussions not just to happen within the arts sector, you know, to involve scientists, to involve economists, to be part of a civic conversation. And I suppose it feels to me that once you've found that place where your professional artistic life and your civic responsibility connect, as is really evident, I think, in all the work that Esther has done, there's no kind of stepping away from that. You know, that's you, and why would you want to step away from it? It's a, you know, it's an authentic self. And I think that's the struggle that we find we want for ourselves and for each other. So it's not a surprise to me that I think, you know, that those conversations just proliferate, and there's more and more of that.
And this is really the crux of cultural leadership, I think. You know, for a time there, arts were going to be engaged in climate change by sort of making theatre pieces about climate change. You know, there was money to do that. And sort of artists, I remember, were going around saying, but how can we make art about climate change? We don't know anything about climate change. We're just a bunch of people in a room. These are big natural processes. You know, the scale was wrong. The wrong voice was being asked to say the wrong thing. And also in Esther's work, I see, you know, your practice kind of being that thing where you put the right question in the right space, in the right context. You make it kind of make sense, and you allow people to understand their own agency, however small or big it may be.
Wow, I hope so. It's I've been thinking about this a lot this year, I think, because of the political environment, because of the regular reflection that I do as part of my practice. You know, I take an annual retreat every year where I just go away and think about all these things. It normally happens in May. It, for all sorts of circumstances, it had to happen much later this year. And I really felt the loss and the discombobulation of that. It was like all these pent-up things I needed to reflect on, and it was transformative this time. It only happened a few weeks ago, and I'm still thinking a lot about just the things that I found myself reflecting on. And when I think about, and Angharad just put it, it's so great this has been recorded because I'm totally going to listen back. Angharad just put it in a really good way about the civic and the artistic and the professional coming together. And as you know, my background is in philosophy and architecture and media, but when I'm always reluctant as a Greek to draw on the classical Greek heritage, because for all the Greek speakers out there, there's a phenomenon called prognopleksia, which is the excessive glorification of the heyday long past. But this is a Greek notion. If we think about the Republic, if we think about the Aristotelian values and the way in which the citizen contributes and the conversations that actually create our world and that are the reality of our politics, whereas the politicians that we see on the news are the sideshow of that politics. We give them a great deal of power that we take away from ourselves, which is a huge mistake. And it's the individual conversations and exchanges that each one of us have and the distribution of those around, you know, the city, the country, the world, that gives us each our strength as individuals and as citizens. And so the ways in which I try to make a public contribution, it would be wonderful if each one of those public contributions gave more people the confidence to do just that, so that we are creating our world together every day.
So Esther, do you consider your writing retreat a part of your practice?
Oh yes, absolutely. But that's just the annual big picture reflection. There are a lot of ways in which I critically reflect. There's kind of an almost daily stream of consciousness journaling. There's my quiet Fridays. You know, I package up my role, so I work longer hours Monday to Thursday, devote Friday to my practice. And there's a kind of a warm-up on a Friday, which is about often mind mapping or my index system project, where I'm indexing the last 20 years of my notebooks and mind maps and sketchbooks, and I've been documenting that on my blog. But look, this is the increasing confidence one has to understand the nature of one's own practice. What previously at different points seemed like an indulgence now seems like an absolute necessity, especially in a role that's about leadership. I used to talk about finding myself in positions of leadership as though I just, you know, stumbled across one day. I mean, that's just ridiculously disingenuous. There's things that I've pursued and been interested in, and I find myself in a position of responsibility, and therefore I need to take that responsibility seriously to think about the way that I work creatively as well as professionally.
I've been thinking a little bit about eldership. You know, as I'm tip over 50. Yeah, and more aware of, and maybe it's also because I'm often working in an area where there are younger artists involved, and finding, you know, looking around and going, oh, here I am. I'm the oldest person in the room, and feeling like probably, not the youngest, but, you know, feeling like I'm with my peers, and then going, oh, they're, you know, I'm talking a bit more than another person might do, or being listened to in a different way. And that's really interesting. And I think that for me, that's a big challenge around how to shift from feeling very connected and, you know, a peer in my community to feeling like, oh, well, actually, I need to make space, and I also need to think about my contribution in a different way.
Perhaps accept that you have a responsibility to show the way or to inform or to teach that perhaps you didn't think about before?
Yeah, I'm a little bit resistant to that idea.
It is a funny thing, though, because, I mean, you know, I'm all of 28, and yet because I'm working within a university structure and in a position with a lot of 20-year-olds coming to me, I weirdly become the elder in that context as well, which feels like such a privilege to be in that position at the age of 28, to be in the position of mentoring people who a couple of years will be considered my peers. But in this moment, I've got this incredibly interesting relationship with them. And I remember I've written a piece for Monash at the moment. And so I'm both in a position as a leader, but then also as a playwright. And it was really interesting them seeing the first reading of that work and seeing how nervous I was. Was, I think, an incredible experience for those guys, because I had a few of them saying to me, we didn't think you'd be nervous. We thought, you know, you've got this. You're a grown-up artist. We didn't expect to see you that anxious. And I sort of went in that moment, oh, I think it's a really good thing for them to see their elders, to use that term very loosely, as confused and petrified in those moments as they are, and to allow them into that uncertainty of creating art, I think is really important.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's, you know, it's another balance, isn't it, between, you know, being able to offer some reassurance and stability and history, knowledge of history and experience of that. But at the same time, how can any of us know what's ahead or what the right pathway might be? I feel like, you know, we're at that point in history, and maybe every generation, you know, every century feels like that. But to me, it feels very clear that no one has the answers and we all need each other. And so whatever was the usual business of growing older and becoming a leader in a particular way is pretty much bound to be irrelevant in terms of what's ahead of us. So, yeah, I mean, it's great. It's kind of, it's challenging though. It's really challenging because I just feel like we're sort of, we've got these old models and, you know, quite strange organisational structures that are just not fit for purpose by and large. And, you know, we really need to remember how to improvise, I think.
So now that we have come to this question of working with people and what Esther has been saying about well-being, and I know that Esther has a keen interest in well-being of arts workers, shall we say, because you have spoken about this in various circumstances. This is very interesting because it's very much in contrast to what often happens in the performing arts, which is that people burn out, that people work very long hours for very little pay, you know, things that we know sort of anecdotally happen. And there was a recent study, which you may have been aware of, conducted by Entertainment Assist with Victoria University, that found that Australian entertainment industry workers were attempting suicide at more than double the rate of the country's population, as in Australia's general population, and very high levels of anxiety and depression. How do you work with people in an ecosystem of this kind? How much do you think about this, and how do you work to ensure that, you know, your employees are doing okay?
I think about this all the time, and yeah, very, very much so. I mean, that study was quite shocking, and those of us in the literary community have been thinking a great deal about suicide this year, given the shocking and upsetting loss of Cat Mascot and the way in which remarkably people have come together in all sorts of really important ways. I mean, in a sense, this bridges the elder conversation. You know, I'm the ripe old age of 40 next birthday, and I was very taken aback when our youth literary community asked me to take on a certain role in that memorial in liaising with Kat's family, who I've known for 10 years. And in thinking about how do we create a space where people can mourn, first of all, and then what are we going to do differently? So I've always worked in organisations with people suffering from mental and physical illness, and there are structural things, and then there is the great weight of the personal self-exploitation that is so, so rife in the arts.
Just quickly, Esther, do you think that it's different between art forms, that it's different in performing arts than it is, say, in the literary community? Or is it a situation that repeats across art forms?
I strongly believe it's a situation that repeats across art forms, and that some art forms are expressive and openly collaborative and some are isolating. And both of those are different kinds of occupational hazards. But I've always worked across art forms, particularly in this role now, and I don't see any difference. And so for me, across a number of years, across a few roles, I have set the extremely high bar, and I put this into our strategic plan, that I expect everyone who works in our organisation at any level to have a career highlight experience of working with us. And I create different ways during business hours for us to talk about art, to talk about mental health. This coming week, actually, we're off on our 3-day annual creative professional development retreat, where we spend 3 days doing, you know, kind of hard professional skills like, you know, communication and conflict and negotiation, but then we also do stuff about emotional intelligence and mindfulness and, you know, a range of ways that we make it not just okay, but a part of the doing of your job to reflect on and talk about these things. You know, we did a 2-day mental health first aid in the workplace workshop just recently, which was quite startling. There's the range of things that we learnt. But one of the things that's made the most difference is our staff salons, which is just a fortnightly half-hour during business hours talk about art. You know, people join arts organisations to engage with art, and often you don't actually get to do that during business hours. You're sort of down at your desk doing what it is you're doing. But what we do with these is that someone different leads it every week, every fortnight rather, and it might just be stuff that we've seen, or it could be, as we've had with one of my colleagues who I admire a great deal, she was going through a whole range of issues with her own mental health, discussing those privately with her immediate team, and then through the ways in which we talked about this as a group, she then led a workshop on mental health in the workplace and talked about a whole range of things that she hadn't really publicly talked about. Then she wrote about it on her blog and on our blog, and now when I kind of see some of her social media engagement, but also the way in which she articulates and writes as a feminist, it's something that grounds the way that she comes across, and I'm so proud of her transformation, if I can call it that, because she is physically healthier and, you know, she is just one person. And, that's meant a great deal. It brings back what we're saying about resilience and disaster recovery. The first priority that we have with everyone that we work with is each other.
Angharad, no, because I'm not there, I don't know if Angharad is really trying to say something or doesn't want to
She's
say anything at all.
I'm really in awe of Esther. I think, she's making a work environment that sounds, you know, just fabulous and empowering for people there. And I suppose in my situation, you know, the City of Melbourne is a massive employment, you know, I think there are, I don't know how many thousand people, but there's a lot of people, and there's a whole HR department, and they have, you know, strong supportive policies. And I suppose I would say personally that I rely on that organisation to do that, and that would be one of my failings, is that I'm overcommitted and embarrassed by how much I work. And it's something that I think about a lot and talk about with my partner and my son and, you know, colleagues as well. And sometimes I feel like, for me, part of some of the work that I do, say, with Tipping Point Australia, which is, you know, outside of Arts House work, whatever outside means, that feels to me like if I didn't do that, my mental health in terms of the stress of contemplating those things and not doing anything about it would, you know, that the balance for me in terms of feeling like I'm able to move on something and find a voice for myself and hopefully for other people, that feels really, really important to me. So, yeah, I'm certainly not in a balanced place, and I feel bad for saying it because I should be modelling something else, but
It is incredible to hear you say that phrase, I'm embarrassed by how much I work, because I think there's a really big culture in the arts industry of being proud of the overwork, yes, of being
the self-exploitation, yeah, I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, absolutely, of being proud of the I've barely slept and, you know, another 17-hour day, that kind of thing. So it's actually, I think just saying I'm embarrassed by how much I work is something that sort of marks you as a cultural leader in that moment. That actually,
yeah, that sounds
I think that that's a really important thing to hear cultural leaders say, that working that overtime, that putting yourself through that isn't a good thing in your books, is a really incredible thing to own.
Yeah, I'm being disingenuous. I don't know whether I think it's a bad thing. It's a compulsion for me, and maybe that's my own mental health issue. But I suppose I feel like at root I've also feel that I don't want to have my life defined by the structures that, I'm sounding really grandiose here, but, you know, that the work-life division feels at heart really artificial to how we are in the world or how we want to be in the world. And in fact, a few years ago we set up a group called Unprofessional Women, which was, the idea was that your passion spilled over and out of whatever it was that you were being restricted into. And I don't know how you balance that with, you know, duty of care and looking after yourself and looking after your colleagues. Yeah.
I think it's really common among all of us. You know, people want to be able to turn their passion into a job, or rather, you know, do what they love. And we end up just being very overworked and also just really busy and sort of turning art into our life and then sort of finding ourselves feeling not as good about it as we maybe should or we believe we should. I mean, I know that both Fleur and I are guilty of that, absolutely, because we have talked about it so many times. Maybe we should all take
notes
from Esther.
Trying to make time to even record this thing is so ridiculous.
For me, it's, I don't know, I mean, I've never made a career plan of any kind. I've had some really fundamental questions that have framed what I've always done, and they're really basic. They're about where to live and how to live and how best to live. But when I think about the balance that I have in my life now, which wasn't always there, then it's also essentially about, you know, the condition of being an embodied woman with a disability and a chronic illness. So I have to maintain a disciplined daily practice. Yeah. It just so happens that what I do in that daily practice are things that I love, that give me energy and focus. And there's a great balance of physical exercise and intellectual engagement and creativity and good people and just doing my best to surround myself with good people. But possibly if I didn't have a disability and a chronic illness, then the impact on my body of doing the boom bust stuff that I did when I was freelance may not have hit me in the ways that it has now. You know, my brain condition is such that when things are particularly bad, you know, I can be in a situation where I can't see, hear, feel, you know, for days at a time. I emerge from that and it becomes the greatest thing in the world and I feel incredibly powerful and capable. And so there's ways that I draw on the sort of darkness of that, but I also try to just be realistic about what I'm capable of and just do my best.
I think there's also something when it comes to mental health in regards to the size of the company that's working as well. And I've just had this week with some students and they're experiencing for the first time really in their life, these designers are experiencing that we've brought in mechs and techs to bring their designs to life. And I've had to have this conversation with these students who are so frightened about building this stuff. And I said, you're not building it. You're the designer. And I know you've got some of those skills, but at this point we've brought in this other stuff. And having that conversation really reminded me of the fact that independent artists go into production weeks, go into creation processes, expecting that they are going to be doing absolutely everything in that mode. And to step into a space where there's any support at all around you is a pleasant surprise, and such a surprise that you're not even necessarily quite sure how to cope with it, and that you have to be told by someone you can stop now is a pretty fascinating thing that someone that's 20 has already learned.
We have such a culture of independence and doing everything by yourself in the arts. You have to be an independent artist, and in the Australian culture in particular, it is even more highly prized. And I wonder what the role is there of an organization that has the resources and that sort of can help or assist, rather, artists. I don't know, Angharad, if you have anything.
Yeah, well, we do, you know, I think two very different approaches. You know, one of the things that I think really distinguishes Arts House is that artists that come and do Culture Lab are given a key to the building and they can come and go as they like. So if they want to work at 1 o'clock in the morning, they can do that. You know, they're inducted, there's no H&S process, but, you know, if they get a creative flow happening and they want to work for as long as they want to work, that's what we provide them. And I think that that's incredibly valuable again. And then I suppose on the other side of that, absolutely, you know, I think that what you're saying, Fleur, of, you know, people going, oh, you mean I don't have to write the press release, put the lights up, mop the floor? People feel, I think, by and large, very supported by the, you know, production processes around the work. But at the same, you know, I think some of the artists, some of that sort of materiality is part of their practice, you know.
Absolutely.
So for some artists, it's really critical that they're engaged with, you know, with mopping the floor, because it's the floor that they're going to dance on. So they need to know it. So again, I think it's about that flexibility of trying to be responsive to what each artist needs. And I mean, again, that sounds pretty grandiose. We've got a certain number of offerings and ways that we can offer, and hopefully people can find the best of that, take the best of that.
Yeah. We might wrap up there, guys. And thank you so much. I do really feel like this conversation got to a really special and really urgent place. And it's so lovely to hear two cultural leaders talking in such detail and with such honesty and frankness about these issues of mental health in their own practice and within their own workspaces feels like such a privilege and something that I'm so glad we can host and just sit back and let you people talk about is just a really special thing. So thank you so much. And thank you, Jana, as well. I'm not sure if you can tell from the recording, but Jana's in Brussels right now, am I right? So thank you so much, Jana, for joining us from afar. So our guests today have been Angharad Wynne-Jones and Esther Anatolitis. You can find us on iTunes or through our website, audiostage.gorillasemiotics.com. Esther and Angharad, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your expertise and wisdom and selves with us for this last hour. It's been so special.
Thank you. Thank you both. There's going to be a few hugs after this.
Oh, I wish I could hug you too.
Big hug, Jana.
It's wonderful, guys.
I will hug the microphone.
That we've got to. How do you feel about wrapping up here? Is there something else you want to?
No, this was really lovely and we're a little bit over time.
So I think it might be a good time. We might wrap up there, guys. And thank you so much. I do really feel like this conversation got to a really special and really urgent place. And it's so lovely to hear two cultural leaders talking in such detail and with such honesty and frankness about these issues of mental health in their own practice and within their own workspaces feels like such a privilege and something that I'm so glad we can host and just sit back and let you people talk about is just a really special thing. So thank you so much. And thank you, Jana, as well. I'm not sure if you can tell from the recording, but Jana's in Brussels right now, am I right? So thank you so much, Jana, for joining us from afar. So our guests today have been Angharad Wynne-Jones and Esther Anatolitis. We'll continue to explore the question of responsibility in our last episode for the season. You can find us on iTunes or through our website, audiostage.gorillasemiotics.com. Esther and Angharad, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your expertise and wisdom and selves with us for this last hour. It's been so special.
Thank you. Thank you both. There's going to be a few hugs after this.
Oh, I wish I could hug you too.
Big hug, Jana. It's wonderful, guys.
I will hug the microphone.
Yeah.